Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. Judge Samuel Alito is again answering questions from the Senate Judiciary Committee on this third day of his Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Democratic senators aggressively questioned Alito about his views on abortion. He continued to say he has an open mind and refused to disavow a 1985 memo in which Alito said the Constitution does not protect the right to abortion. Joining us on the line is Ted Goldman, congressional correspondent with the Legal Times, and he's covering the hearings. Ted, it sounds like the issues are similar to what we heard yesterday. What about the tone of the hearings? What's it like today?
Feels pretty much the same. If anything, there may be just a slight bump. People, this thing is really not starting off with any fireworks. It's a bit duller, actually, than anybody had really anticipated. The Democrats are going at him hard, but not as hard as people had expected. And he's holding his ground, Alito.
There was an exchange today between Judge Alito and Illinois Senator Richard Durbin where Alito said the Roe versus Wade decision that legalized abortion is an important precedent, but he didn't necessarily say it was settled law. Is there anything different here from what we've been hearing from Alito?
No, not at all, actually. He said virtually the same thing when Senator Schumer, the Democrat from New York, who's also probably one of the Democrats' toughest attack dogs, went at him yesterday at the very end of the hearings with the same ideas. But just to let you know, Senator Hatch, Orrin Hatch, the former chairman who's a Republican from Utah, just came on during his 20-minute round and offered a correction to that. Apparently, Roberts had not said that Roe is settled law during his Supreme Court Chief Justice confirmation hearings. He'd actually said that in 2003, I believe, when he was before the Senate Judiciary Committee for a Court of Appeals seat. And in that case, for the Court of Appeals, as Hatch pointed out, it's a lot easier to say Roe is settled law because for an appeals court judge, it is settled law.
So not necessarily a difference here with Chief Justice John Roberts.
No, not necessarily at all.
Okay. Tomorrow was supposed to be the last day of these hearings. Do you think that will happen tomorrow?
Well, people are hoping that it is the last day of the hearings.
Because it hasn't been very exciting, yes?
No, and once you watch these guys a few times, they almost become stock characters. They generally tend to act as you would expect, the senators, that is.
Mm. No surprise issues, then. What other issues besides abortion, Ted?
Well, separation of powers, the executive branch power, and what's become very crucial in this hearing and has sort of preoccupied a lot of the Democrats is the whole problem with the wiretapping that's come out in the last month. There is a special court that allows wiretapping. There's been wiretapping without authorization from the court. Is that appropriate? And the senators have been they've questioned Alito pretty closely about whether the president can actually authorize something that violates a statute, the statute that set up the secret court that is supposed to authorize these wiretaps.
And Alito's response has been?
He said nobody is above the law, including the president, which, as you may, sounds good, but on the other hand, of course he's going to say that. It's as Schumer said, that we're not living in a monarchy.
Mm-hmm. So based on what you've heard so far, what do you think? Will he be confirmed?
I think the money's definitely on that he'll be confirmed. The interesting question is how many votes will he get? You've got 55 Republicans and 44 Democrats plus an independent who always votes with them. So almost certainly you'll have 55 votes unless a couple of the main senators who are women who are pro-choice advocates vote against him. But you'll probably have at least 55 and probably maybe 10. I'm saying 10. I'd say it's going to be 60 to 65 in favor.
No signs of filibuster, then?
No. It would be very tough to pull off. And even if they pulled it off, the political relations problem would be immense.
Ted Goldman, a congressional correspondent with the Legal Times, who is covering the confirmation hearings for Judge Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
For the past 4 months, hundreds of people from Washington to Louisiana have been working on a plan to rebuild New Orleans after the destruction from Hurricane Katrina. Today, the Bring New Orleans Back Commission, appointed by Mayor Ray Nagin, starts releasing what's described as an ambitious master plan for the city. And as one commission member predicts, it's going to be a rough ride. That's because one of the most hotly contested questions is whether rebuilding should take place at all in the most heavily damaged parts of the city. It's a politically and racially charged issue because those who lived in the worst-hit areas were primarily African-American and poor. Gary Rivlin of the New York Times has been covering this story, and he joins us on the line from New Orleans. Gary, before we talk about the plan briefly, could you tell us the condition of the city and are people moving back? What's happening?
Well, in a way, it's two different cities. If you're in the French Quarter, the Central City, or the Uptown Garden District area, the city more or less looks pretty normal. The restaurants are full. Bourbon Street is full of people partying. But then you venture out of that small island, and it's largely vacant. You could just drive for 15, 20 minutes and just go block after block and see no one. It's like a ghost town. The houses are there. But there's just no people.
So the heavily damaged areas that were hit during the storm are probably the ones that are completely vacant and probably still look as bad as they did back a couple of months ago. What is the panel saying about those hard-hit areas like the Ninth Ward and New Orleans East?
I mean, this has been the most vexing question. It's really, there's, you know, two sides. There's the planners and so-called experts who say, hey, listen, New Orleans is going to, you know, lose 40% or so of its residents, so shrink the city. There's areas of the city that are low-lying, below sea level, so why don't you just say, okay, there's no rebuilding in these areas, we'll return it to marshland. And, of course, there's the residents who want to move back or are determined to move back, and so the compromise that was reached is, okay, we're going to give you 4 or 5 months, communities in devastated areas, and we'll give you the services of experts, planners, financial planners, etc. And we're going to help you come up with a plan to come back. And the question is, can you amass enough people to justify rebuilding and the expensive city services and utilities that you would have? Will you have enough people to justify a local school? Will you have enough people to justify businesses coming in and catering to you, laundromats, restaurants, grocery stores, what have you? Because the big fear is that it's going to be what planners call the jack-o'-lantern effect, that there'll be blocks where two or three houses here will be occupied, two or three houses there will be occupied, but largely will be empty with either abandoned houses or just simply spaces with no house there. There is a strong coterie of people who are determined to come back. I mean, New Orleans is the kind of city where people were born here and people die here, and they're very connected to their neighborhood, and they know it and they love it, and they don't really know much else. And so, you know, each community is going to have a nucleus, and then the question is, can they reach enough of their former neighbors or neighbors who are living elsewhere to convince them to come back? But what you're getting at is true. The devil is in the details in this. Like, how are you going to get people back, and what is the number, and what is the cutoff, and who's going to determine whether or not a community is worthy of coming back and which one is not?
Right, and that's up to who?
This plan has been going right up to the wire, as you mentioned. The overview is coming out, but as of this weekend, it was being changed, and changed dramatically. And so there is going to be some kind of central city body, but, you know, who's going to sit on it, what the racial makeup's going to be. So race will play a factor, and also class. You know, we're talking about the fate of a lot of poor folks here, and, you know, will they have a voice? What kind of voice will they have?
If people do go back into an area, would there be services then to lure them back, to try to determine this viability issue? And also, is there a chance that if they then do go back and then it's determined it's not viable, would they be told then that they would have to go?
So what the commission is going to announce later today is that the city should not grant any permits for rebuilding in any of the badly flooded parts of the city to prevent people from pouring a lot of sweat equity, not to mention actual money, into rebuilding. And so that's going to, assuming the mayor accepts that idea, that's going to freeze for a time. As far as essential services, finally electrical service, finally water and gas service are back to virtually the entire city. I mean, it's 4.5 months later, and it's only now that the city probably has 90% or more electrical, water, gas service. But you raise a good point. Let's say the city greenlights this neighborhood coming back, and people rebuild, people invest. But then 3 years from now, it's half vacant. It's two-thirds vacant. I mean, anyone who's lived in an urban center knows that
a neighborhood that is only half occupied and the other half of the houses are unoccupied or just vacant lots is a neighborhood that's pretty much heading down, not up. And do you want to live somewhere where the nearest grocery store is 5 miles away? Because, you know, businesses are going to make decisions based on how many people are there. So, you know, this is clearly not as bad a recommendation to the neighbors as the original one that was floated, which is to say we're going to put off rebuilding or even working on the most hardest hit neighborhoods for, you know, an indefinite period of time. This is a shorter window. But on the other hand, this could be a very, very painful process looking back several years from now.
Mm-hmm. If people couldn't go back, would they be compensated?
Well, this commission is calling on them to be compensated, but it's also not their money. They want the federal government to compensate people 100% of the value of their home prior to Katrina, minus insurance, etc. But I think the bigger question mark is what kind of federal commitment will there be? What kind of financial commitment will there be? I mean, everybody knows that there are budget woes in Washington, D.C. with an expensive war and cutting taxes, etc. You know, is the money there? The president, who's coming to New Orleans on Thursday, you know, has said that we are committed and we're going to rebuild a great American city. But how much money will he put up, will the Congress put up, is a big question.
There's also a very ambitious timetable here. The commission hopes that Mayor Nagin will sign off by next week?
It has to be ambitious. I mean, the clock has been ticking all along. I mean, the president gives his State of the Union address on January 20th, and, you know, it's hoped that he'll spend some time talking about the Gulf Coast region in New Orleans. And, you know, people are living in hotels. People are living scattered around the country, and they just want to know, can we come back? They want to plan their lives. I mean, what are they going to do with their school kids? I mean, there's really this sense here, and I think it's accurate, that there's kind of a Katrina fatigue that, you know, we're starting, New Orleans is already starting to fade, and if they go to Washington 2 years from now asking for money, so they really feel like they need to go now and soon when Congress is still paying attention, when there's still sympathy.
Gary Rivlin is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke to us from New Orleans. Just ahead, we'll talk with an advisor to the New Orleans Commission on its rebuilding plan and how a federal flood map of the city will be critical to the commission's recommendations. Also, what one New Orleans resident thinks should happen in her neighborhood. Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. Now, we've been talking about the recommendations being released today by the commission reviewing how to rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. A group that's been advising the Bring New Orleans Back Commission is the Urban Land Institute. Tom Murphy is with that group. And Tom, your organization has supported a broader dialogue with the neighborhoods and not a ban on rebuilding in the hard-hit areas of New Orleans. Is that right?
We would believe that people need to sit down and decide as a community what they want to do. And the report that will come out today that the Rebuild Committee had hired a consultant to develop with them really highlights that very in great detail about creating 13 planning districts and having a very extensive community conversation about what kind of community people want to have.
Do you think that there are enough safeguards in place there to make sure that safety issues are addressed before?
Well, I think the major issue is really the issue of the conditions of the levee. And if you the feeling is by everybody involved in this process is that we have to assume the federal government, taking the federal government at their word, that the levees will be by this summer constructed to Category 3 pre-hurricane status, in better shape. The other big issue that everybody is waiting for are what are called FEMA maps, which are the maps that are going to determine where there is likelihood of additional flooding, not with a serious storm like Katrina, but even in moderate storms, and that those areas would not be eligible for flood insurance, and that would make it more difficult to build in those areas.
And when are those expected?
They should be coming any day.
You know, this storm brought up quite a few issues about race and class in New Orleans. How do you ensure that when those extensive conversations are going on about the viability of the neighborhoods, that enough voices and all voices really are adequately represented and heard in those discussions?
Well, there's been a lot of effort to identify the residents and identify where they are. And so I think people's response has been included. I think people have tried to listen.
In reading about this plan, it appears that city officials predict quite a significant drop in New Orleans' population.
Everybody sees that, right?
Right. What do you predict for the city?
I think we predicted that the population, which is about, pre-Katrina, was about 464,000 people, that it maybe in 10 years might be in about 300,000. I mean, New Orleans is a special place, and I think that what has made it a special place, its people, its culture, its wonderful architecture, a lot of that remains or can come back if this decision gets made quickly. And the longer this goes on, the more unlikely it is that people will make a decision to come back. So I think first and foremost, decisions have to be made very quickly and to give people some comfort that things are going to happen and there's a place for them in New Orleans.
Tom Murphy is with the Urban Land Institute, a group that's been advising the commission, releasing recommendations today about how to rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Harice Harrison has lived in New Orleans East for the past 40 years. She and her late husband Donald raised their four children in their four-bedroom house, which was virtually destroyed by Katrina. Mrs. Harrison is now renting an apartment in Houston, and she joins us on the line from a hotel near the New Orleans airport where she's visiting this week. Mrs. Harrison, do you plan to move back to New Orleans?
Yes, I really do. I want to come back. I want to stay in that area. I have ties to that area. I'm connected to that area. And I want to do that. As it stands, I'm concerned about safety. The first key factor in my safety would be to have the levees raised to a Category 5 capability. Why would I want to go back when I feel that in 5 months or I'll be facing the same dilemma. A hurricane could come across the Gulf and do the same thing all over again. And so if I've repaired the house completely by that time, I'm facing the same danger. And the next thing should be that I should have a voice in what happens to my neighborhood. I lived there for all of those years. I have invested my life and everything into that area. And I'm just connected to it. And I want to have that say, and I feel that I should have that right to determine what happens, and the city government, state government, and federal government should be assisting me in trying to do that, you know. I bought into the American dream of buying a home and trying to insure it properly, and I just feel that my voice should be heard. I should have a say in that.
Have you been back to your neighborhood?
Yes, I've been back. I've gutted the house out, and I've done everything, you know, that I feel that I can do at this point. And I feel the hopelessness riding through the neighborhood, seeing, you know, that very few people are back, and just the devastation of the area.
Do you think that most folks from the neighborhood are suspect when they hear that they will be involved in this process to determine if the neighborhood is viable and whether rebuilding will then take place?
I feel that they do not feel that they will be allowed, to voice their concerns, and that is very unfortunate because they're the ones that's affected, and it's a large area of home ownership, and so I mean they've paid taxes, they've been viable citizens, and I just feel that the American way would be for them to be part of that process.
And local politicians have not been helpful?
I have not had anyone really helpful to me. You know, I don't know what they could do. I mean, I'm not expecting them to come down to the neighborhood and say anything to me, but I'm expecting them to, when they speak out in public or when they put together commissions or talk, you know, that everything that they would say would be something that I would want to hear, not everything that I'm hearing that's making me feel powerless.
Mrs. Harrison, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Harise Harrison has been a resident of New Orleans East for more than 40 years. She's currently living in Houston, but hopes to move back to her city soon. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from
Binyang. It's Here and Now. By most accounts, Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito hardly flagged at all during almost 9.5 hours of questioning at his Senate confirmation hearings yesterday. He faces what's expected to be another long day of grilling today, and more is in store for him tomorrow, which begs the question, how does someone maintain mental and physical alertness for that length of time? Dr. Amy Kimball is director of mental training at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Center for Sports Medicine. She advises athletes and business people about peak performance. And Dr. Kimball, you've been checking in on the hearings. How's Judge Alito doing?
Oh, he looks to be doing very well. He's very in control of his answers right now.
And what do people need to do, or what qualities do people need to inherently have to be able to get through hours and hours of questioning like this?
Well, I've worked with marathoners before, and running that long of a distance is definitely endurance, both physically and mentally. And one of the things that works really well is recognize that it's going to be a long event, but to break it down into smaller pieces. So for Judge Alito, just focus on one questioner at a time. So don't think about what happened in the past or how much longer there is to go. Just stay focused in the moment and in who is talking to you and what the question at hand is.
Look for that little light at the end of the little tunnel.
Right. Break it down into manageable parts.
What about adrenaline because of all the pressure involved and what's happening? Does that help or does that hinder performance?
Well, I think in this situation, the adrenaline definitely helps because it can really keep you focused. Sometimes if you don't have that adrenaline, boredom can set in, as some people realize after sitting through a long class in college. And what adrenaline does, it helps you to narrow your focus.
What about the repetition? I mean, a lot of times we hear the same questions, basically. Does that interfere with someone's ability to stay focused?
Well, it depends how you approach that repetition. I think a lot has to come down with attitude. If he's able to say, oh, I've already heard this question and I've already answered it well, that can really be a positive for him. But if instead he's like, oh, here we go again, I have to answer it again, then that's a more negative attitude, which then can hinder his performance.
What, in a case like this, should someone do during very minimal periods of downtime in an intense situation like this?
Well, probably as little as possible. Take the time to mentally relax, because he has to have such an intense focus over such an extended period that those 15 minutes he can mentally tune out if he needs to. Maybe the 5 minutes before he goes back in, sort of have a routine that he can get into, so that it can get him refocused on what he needs to do.
Exercising beforehand, any of those kinds of things?
The more fit he is going into it, the more his endurance is going to be.
What about also just keeping your emotions in check, making sure you don't get angry when you're asked the same question over again so you do have a good attitude or something, or get frustrated or something like that?
Well, the first thing, a deep breath is always a good way to go. You hear it over and over, but when things are frustrating, just taking that deep breath automatically slows your system down. Another thing you can do is have a trigger word or action that gets you refocused the way that you want to. So before he speaks, he can simply tell himself relax or stay focused, and that can help him calm down as well. I think that the longer it goes, the harder it is for him to maintain the focus that he wants, but really it comes down to motivation and effort. The more motivated he is to stay focused, the easier that will be. And the more effort he puts into staying focused, then he'll be able to. But again, fatigue makes this a lot harder. And so his answers may be more candid later on.
Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Dr. Amy Kimball is Director of Mental Training at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Center for Sports Medicine. That's the song Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who with Pete Townsend on guitar. Townsend is now 60 years old. He's still playing guitar, but he's partially deaf, and he says that was caused by years of listening to loud music through headphones. Hearing loss affects not only musicians, a whole generation of portable audio owners also may be at risk. So what to do about an iPod? And should you wear earplugs when you go to a concert? Dr. Roland Evie with the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary and Harvard Medical School joins us in studio to talk about those questions and others. Welcome, Doctor.
Hello, Deb. How are you?
Okay. Well, how prevalent do you think is hearing loss?
Hearing loss in the general population is very prevalent and may be the most prevalent condition that people have. We did a piece for Rolling Stone recently, and the author said it's an open secret in the music industry that there's a lot of hearing loss.
So, but do people know it?
Hearing loss tends to be gradual. It's not an all or none phenomenon. So they can have some hearing loss and then a little more hearing loss, and they can turn up the TV volume and ask someone to speak more loudly and cover it for a while. But actually, hearing loss is cumulative. So as you have another experience and another experience, that can start you down the road to permanent hearing loss.
What about earplugs? I know you brought some in here, and do you think that people will wear these, and do they really help?
They can help an awful lot, and they're inexpensive, and they're easy to obtain, and they won't take away the music. Some people have the incorrect impression that you'll hear sound, and if you put in an earplug, you'll be silent. And they say, well, what's the point of going to a concert if you can't hear
right,
the music?
Right.
And this takes it to the point where it's still quite loud, but it's not uncomfortable, not painful.
And then what about the whole iPod thing and those earphones? I have a teenage son, and I never know whether he's listening or not, and I'm talking to him and yelling, and he can't hear me. And are those really causing hearing damage? Can I tell him that you said so?
In theory, they really can. What you do when you take – you have a personal player that you're wearing is – you are doing the same thing you would do as if you put a jackhammer next to your ear. The difference is music is just great, and jackhammers aren't. It's toxic. So you withdraw from the jackhammer.
Right.
You turn up the iPod or your Sony Walkman or whatever to override the sound because it's so much more pleasant. But in fact, that does more damage. So the iPod rule of thumb is if someone else turns to you and said, hey, what a way cool song you're listening to. It's too loud.
What are some of the other rules that you would suggest that people adhere to try to save their hearing?
If it's painful, put your fingers in your ears or move back if you have to go to the last row in the concert, or if you have to leave the club, use earplugs. Rest your ears. You could be in a situation where it's fairly loud, but if you can get away from it and then come back to it and rest your ears, that will help. Basically, the protection is much better than treatment because there is no good treatment. With noise-induced hearing loss, hearing aids, for example, are not likely to be as successful for hearing loss of other reasons because not only do you lose your hearing, you start getting distortion of sound.
This is permanent, serious stuff.
Permanent.
Anything else?
Music is great. Enjoy it. And you can enjoy it longer if you keep the volume down.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Dr. Ron Evie is co-author of a Harvard study on the health risks of listening to loud music. He's also director of pediatric otolaryngology at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary. Still to come, 9/11 inspires some dancers to create a personal piece called Home Movies. You're listening to Here and Now. The old saying, sleep tight, don't let the bedbugs bite, may become more popular because of an increase in the incidence of biting bedbugs. And joining us to talk about this is Dr. Richard Pollack. He's an entomologist at Harvard University School of Public Health. Dr. Pollack, first off, I thought there was really no such thing as bedbugs. What are they?
Oh, they're insects that have come back to plague us. They've pretty much dropped off the map for several decades, but they're back. And they have a nasty habit of attacking people and sucking blood.
Because that's what they feed off of.
That's the only thing that they'll feed on.
Why do you think they're coming back now?
That's a good question. If I knew that, perhaps I would be able to make a lot more money. There are lots of theories, but in reality, we just don't really know for sure.
How did you realize that they were coming back?
Up to about 5-6 years ago, it was fairly rare for anybody to call with a question about bed bugs. Now it's about a dozen calls before lunchtime every day. Our colleagues elsewhere around the country, throughout North America, parts of Europe, Australia, have noticed the same thing. And the pest control folks are reporting pretty much the same situation as well.
So what are some of the symptoms that you're hearing about from folks when they make these complaints?
Well, some people are actually seeing bugs. We also hear a lot about people complaining about bites at night. They're not seeing anything. They don't know what it is that's affecting them.
So what do they look like, and how do you know it's a bed bug?
Imagine something about the size of a small cockroach, about the same color. These things tend to be hang around where a person's sleeping and feed on people at night.
Now, their biting doesn't hurt, correct?
Generally, people don't even notice it. You're sound asleep. These things are active in the wee hours of the night. The bite is painless, but it can itch like crazy afterwards.
But there's nothing toxic in their bite or anything, or health issues, really, from...
Bed bugs are not known to transmit anything that would cause disease.
You said that somebody needs to make sure it's a bed bug before they take the next step. Tell me how you make sure it's a bed bug if they only come out at night and you're sleeping. What's some of the recommendations?
Well, because it can be very costly to manage bed bugs, usually you have to have a pest control operator come in and help you with this. It really is important to confirm that what you're dealing with truly is a bed bug. So if you are suffering from bites, odd sorts of symptoms like that at night, do look for the bugs. What you should do is pull back the sheets, examine the mattress, the box spring, the bed frame, and some of the furniture nearby. Look for, of course, moving bugs. And these things, when they hatch out, can be quite small, about the size of a little bit bigger than a poppy seed. As adults, they're about a quarter of an inch long. You might see other telltale signs, such as little blood spots, which would be your blood, that the bugs leave behind, often on the sheets, on the mattress, and those are giveaways.
Can I just say yuck?
Yeah.
Yuck. If you're clean enough, can you make sure that this doesn't happen to you?
No, because these things don't respect your level of cleanliness, your parental skills, or anything like that. They're just as happy in a squeaky clean house as they are in a house with lots of junk inside.
So, Dr. Pollack, what advice would you give to people who have this problem?
Some people are able to manage these things on their own, but I generally warn against that. But beyond that, I think most people who have a bed bug problem need to consult with a pest control operator, a licensed professional. It would be advisable to get several different estimates. They really are out there. They really are burdensome to people, and people should take steps to reduce the risk of bringing them into the home. They travel mainly on personal effects of people. So if you see a really nice piece of furniture out on the street, I would encourage people to look carefully. Recycling is good, but be wary. There may be a reason why that desk or that bed or that mattress is on the street, and it may be because people were plagued with bed bugs and they got rid of their furniture.
Dr. Pollack, thanks very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Richard Pollack is with the Harvard School of Public Health. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Now, home and family are the main themes of a theater piece that a tight-knit group of dancers from Rhode Island is bringing to the stage. Home Movies weaves together the true family stories of five dancers, creating a heart-wrenching and sometimes hilarious look at life in America. Real home movies are shown behind the performers, a diverse bunch with different shapes and sizes and levels of dance training. They not only dance their stories, but tell them on stage. The work was inspired by 9/11 and the performers' meditations on home and security. Dancer Marvin Novogrodsky describes home movies.
It's a movement collage. It's a seamless collage of movement. And along with seeing our differences, it's very easy to see the similarities. And even though we may have had different kinds of lives growing up, there's been tragedy and triumph in all our lives.
Here and Now's Lynn Manigan recently caught a rehearsal where she asked the dancers about their stories. Aaron Jungles co-founded Everett Dance Theater with his mother and sister Rachel. On stage, he tells the story of how, when he was 10 years old, his parents let him and his 12-year-old brother take a 300-mile bike trip from Rhode Island to Maine alone.
Then, at about 6:30, the odometer on my brother's bike said we had gone 120 miles. So we stopped in a small town, bought some spaghetti to boil up, and some ketchup to put on it, and we went out of town and walked our bikes into the woods behind a billboard. We started a fire, and while the spaghetti water was boiling, I started to feel feverish. And then the sun went down, and I started to get scared. And I started crying while we were eating our spaghetti. My brother Mark said, "You want to go to town? We could call Mom and Dad." I thought that was a great idea.
What does this piece say about America?
I mean, when we started, me and Rachel thought, well, our family and our backgrounds are sort of the most normal and sort of boring and middle class or whatever. But then as we started telling the stories and as my father heard them, he said, "Boy, you really make me sound like a freak." And we're like, "Whoa, we didn't mean to." So, you know, when you really dig into it, there are things that sort of surprise you that you don't think of as your own sort of background or story.
All of my friends were in gangs.
Join up, so
a good friend of mine. He asked me,
"Soak, you gonna join?"
I don't know.
The parents of dancer Sokio Ross fled Cambodia to escape the Khmer Rouge.
As a performer, when I first started performing this, it was a little bit uncomfortable because I didn't know my story. So me and Aaron actually sat down and interviewed my parents for about 2 hours, and I found out, you know, a lot of things I didn't know. I learned 75% of my history through that interview and the process of making this piece. So for me to actually just learn that and then give it to the audience right away, it was kind of difficult for me. You know, it was hard for me to adjust.
We'll give you a deal. You get jumped in, but you don't get jumped out.
And you didn't join the gang?
Nope. Fortunately, I didn't. So I'm here today.
If you had, would you be here today?
No, I'd probably be in jail or dead. Two choices.
I don't know.
That's it.
Do I want to? Do I not? Do I want to? Do I not? But he kept pressuring me.
You have 24 hours to get rid of the body. My father never took up life insurance. My family had just gone bankrupt.
Dancer Bravel Smith describes the death of his father and not having enough money to bury him or buy the family home.
The owner, who's a friend of mine, said, "I can have my father take him and we can hold him at our funeral home."
The company always works from personal stories.
Everett Dance Theater's Dorothy Jungles directs the creative process.
Dorothy spends a lot of hours. She videotapes everything we do in rehearsal, so we'll have a theme. For this particular piece, it was home movies, home families, and we'll have a theme, and then we, the performers, different days we come to rehearsals and we have maybe a question. So, you know, tell us about an experience. This is just an example. Tell us about a moment that changed your life. Dorothy then asked us to create movement through improvisational games that we've gathered and created over the years, and then she takes the two. So sometimes you may have audio that doesn't have movement set to it yet, Or you could have vice versa. You could have movement that's not even yours, that's someone else's. But Dorothy sees it and says, well, you know what? For some reason, I kind of see you holding your father. She doesn't say this, but in her mind, I'm thinking this is what she's thinking. You know, I kind of see that that's you holding your father, and this particular piece of text would support that.
Before my father died, he had a lawyer telling him he should be receiving money from the state for his disability. The checks finally came 2 months after he passed away. If the state had paid my family on time, we might not have lost our home. So many things may have been different. I remember my family pretty much fighting to keep our house, living there even after the bank had foreclosed on the property. If I ever had the money and the opportunity ever came up, I would buy this house. I would buy this house back for my mother.
I wanted to be a model, an actress, a dancer. I was 15. I knew what to wear and how to wear it. I looked good.
Dancer Rachel Jungles studied dance at Juilliard in New York after a wild childhood.
He was the one guy that was a real sugar daddy. He'd take me out, buy me all kinds of presents. There was a girl from school in the club that night. She said to me, you know you really shouldn't be messing with him. I found out he was a pimp.
We are also connected, and the man on the street has a story, and everybody has a story, and that it's... You know, I think it's a brave thing to bring it on stage like this. You know, I realized that we were so engrossed in our rehearsal process that the first time we performed a little snippet where I say that I was dating a pimp, I didn't actually realize that I was saying that in front of an audience. And we were doing it at this sort of dinner awards party. And all of a sudden I looked out and I say, and I found out he was a pimp. And I thought to myself, did I just say that in front of all these people sitting out here? You know, it's sort of like... Wow, that's insane. But, you know, it is insane. Life is insane, and we all go through so many different things. And, you know, even that story, I mean, I have certain women who come up to me, you know, and they were sort of more of the wild teenager too, you know, and so they can relate. And everyone's family has struggled. Everyone has losses and, as Marvin said, triumphs and tragedies.
Dancer Marvin Novogradsky.
At what point do people just drop their guard for like a minute and just say, I'm a human being? And can we just communicate with each other and deal with it, you know? And I think that's one of the, I don't know, one of the tones of this piece is just drop your guard a little bit and let's realize that we're all, you know, in the same boat, no matter what our experiences are.
For the first time in you, I'll sleep like a dog.
Everett Dance Theater will perform Home Movies in Cambridge, Massachusetts this week. Our piece was produced by Lynn Menegon. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young returns tomorrow. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker.